Never think. Now, they might not be surprised by the Bluffer's Guide to the History of Philosophy, that he wrote that, and there are copies of this available in the bookstore if you want to get a copy. It's fascinating reading. But they would probably be astounded to know that this guy wrote his first book when he was in his early 20s. This is it, right here, Francis Schaeffer's Apologetics. I remember reading it when I was a college student. And they would probably be surprised to know that before he hit 35, he'd published in all the major philosophical and theological journals and published books with a number of the major academic presses. They would be surprised to know that. but now the people that just know him by his books, the people that have been following his academic career, you know, people in Britain, let's say, that just read his books, have never seen this guy in the flesh, they probably have this image that he sits around in his office, reading, studying, never has time for students. They probably have the picture of a guy who couldn't communicate his way out of a wet paper bag if he had to. But of course, they are wrong. So you see here a model, I'm trying to say to you, of what we at Asbury talk a lot about, namely integration. Tom Morris manages to have something to say and to say it very well. I'm reminded also of the foreword to Tom's first book. Speaking about Francis Schaeffer, the writer of the foreword said, "An outstanding 20th century example of the combination of apologist and evangelist is Francis A. Schaeffer. Indeed, he has often publicly claimed to be nothing more than an old-time evangelist." And I couldn't help but thinking, you know, of that line, Thomas, as you were talking this week. I mean, given your philosophical accomplishments, as great as they are, we can hardly say you're just an old-time evangelist. But you certainly have something of the old-time evangelist in you, doesn't he? I mean, I think Henry Clay Morrison would be proud of this guy. Don't you? So we have also seen, I think, this week, that great preaching and great evangelism has a powerful intellectual component to it. So I have heard your positive comments, and I know I speak for you when I say, Tom, we are very delighted that you were able to accept our invitation, and we are very eager to hear your third lecture today. Tom?
Thank you. Good morning. Today we're going to talk about faith, reason, and Christian truth, according to Pascal. I'm going to start off reading you a key passage from the Pensées. Actually, the first time I ever read Pascal, I was a graduate student at Yale, and I had a very prominent scholar leading me in a graduate seminar on the Pensées. I came to believe that this very prominent European scholar completely misunderstood Pascal. He thought of Pascal as an irrationalist, a person who wanted us all to leap out in faith. Let me read you a prominent passage late in the Pensées, which gives, I think, Pascal's actual attitude toward evidence. This is passage number 835. I think it's one of the most crucial passages in the whole book for understanding Pascal's entire project. He says this, "The prophecies, even the miracles and proofs of our religion, are not of such a kind that they can be said to be absolutely convincing, but they are at the same time such that it cannot be said to be unreasonable to believe in them. There is thus evidence and obscurity to enlighten some and obfuscate others. But the evidence is such as to exceed, or at least equal, the evidence to the contrary, so that it cannot be reason that decides us against following it, and can therefore only be concupiscence and wickedness of heart. Thus there is enough evidence to condemn and not enough to convince. so that it should be apparent that those who follow it are prompted to do so by grace and not by reason, and those who evade it are prompted by concupiscence and not by reason. Now, this is a complex passage that says an awful lot. There are three themes here in this one passage. Number one, the balance of evidence available to us concerning Christian truth. Number two, the role of the will in our response to that evidence. Number three, the role of God's grace in our responding to that evidence. Very interesting. Pascal was one of the first empirical scientists. In his own time, intellectuals were debating whether there could be such a thing as a vacuum in nature. You know, and they would trade slogans like, nature abhors a vacuum, some would say, and others would say, no, it is possible. And they were arguing on completely a priori grounds. Reason alone, armchair science. Pascal said, you can't do armchair science. You have to get out and do experiments, make observations, gather evidence. And he was the first person who actually performed experiments which taught us about atmospheric pressure in his quest to understand the dispute over the vacuum. Now, Pascal was a person who always followed the evidence, who always looked for whatever evidence was available concerning any question he broached. Even as a mathematician, his concrete imagination was what led the way to his innovations. Pascal thinks of the evidence as very important. When you read the Pensées carefully, you see that the vast majority of the book is taken up with a consideration of the evidence available for Christian truth. And yet, remember the topic we talked about yesterday afternoon, and yet Pascal realizes that God has reasons to remain, to some extent, hidden. There is a balance of revelation and hiddenness. There is evidence sufficient to enlighten some and obfuscate others. Very interesting theme in Pascal. The evidence, Pascal believes, is such as to exceed the evidence to the contrary, he says, or at least equal. Pascal really believes that if you're properly observant, if you're perceptive, in the right way. And we're going to talk about that today. What it is to be truly perceptive concerning the evidence for religious truth. If you're truly perceptive, you'll see the evidence. You'll see God. But if you are blinding yourself to the evidence, even though the evidence is out there, the best you'll be able to see is that we live in an ambiguous world, the evidence being balanced. Pascal hopes to give us some considerations to lead us out of ambiguity into light. And that's what we're going to look at today. We could take many hours discussing the various forms of evidence Pascal marshals for the Christian faith. Let me just give you a sense of the sweep of all the categories of evidence Pascal talks about in the Pensées. And I'll say a word or two about each category. I'll say a few more words about one or two of the categories. But again, it would take us many hours to detail Pascal's arguments, sometimes extraordinarily clever and insightful arguments. Christian anthropology. Pascal believes that a significant sign of the truth of Christian theology is what it has to say about you and me. What it has to say about humankind, our condition and our plight. Pascal made famous two themes in talking about humankind. The greatness, he said, and the wretchedness of man, in his words. The greatness and wretchedness. Pascal believed that most philosophies and most anthropologies throughout history had erred in one or the other of two directions. Either sensing our greatness and forgetting our wretchedness, or wallowing in our wretchedness to the exclusion of our greatness. You see that, for example, in the 19th century progressive views of humanity. The world is getting better and better all the time, an evolution of morality and intelligence and everything. There'll never be war again. And of course,
the early 20th century refuted all that unbridled optimism, the greatness to the exclusion of the wretchedness. And then you see an inversion with some existentialist philosophies, wallowing in the wretchedness of humanity, forgetting our greatness. Pascal said, no view of the world can be true which does not capture both the greatness and wretchedness tied up in human nature, in the human condition, us as we are now. Pascal believed the Christian faith has a diagnosis of humanity, its potential and problems, the like of which is not to be found anywhere else on the face of the earth. And that was a significant mark of the truth of the Christian faith. Number two, Pascal gives what's widely been known as a success argument. This can be a very dangerous form of argument because there are versions of a success argument for Christianity that obviously don't work. We read, for example, in the pages of Athanasius, St. Athanasius on the incarnation of the Word, for example. Athanasius says, the Christian faith is spreading every day. Idols are falling in the face of the onslaught of Christian truth. The world is being won for Christ, and that's a mark of its truth. Well, if you look at Athanasius's reasoning carefully, you would expect, in a very short time after his having written on the incarnation of the Word, the entire world would have been Christian. And we find that has not happened. Why? Well, it should not be a surprise to us, because it's part of Christian theology that we have free will. We are free to resist the truth, even when it stares us in the face. The success argument that Pascal gives is interestingly different. Success as a mark of the truth, it can be understood this way. It's a remarkable mark of the truth of the Christian faith that it has been able to change people's lives qualitatively in every historical period since its inception, in every culture in which it's been introduced. Christianity as the only universally available faith. Now, when we look at the variety of religions on the surface of the earth and the ways in which they have grown and flourished and waxed and waned, it's difficult to find anything else with a universal appeal of the Christian faith. Some people say, well, you know, Zen Buddhism in certain forms has been able to be transported from one culture to another, but only to the extent that it becomes very philosophical and is no longer a religion. It's a very interesting phenomenon. So Pascal's version of a success argument is not the quantitative version. It's more like a qualitative version and bears looking into. Thirdly, he has something else to say about world religions that's very interesting. Many of Pascal's friends, and in the 17th century, quite a bit was being learned about Confucianism, about Islam, about other traditions. Pascal's friends were saying, basically, look, the Christian religion is not utterly unique. There are themes in Christian theology which are to be found in other religious traditions. So there's no reason to believe that Christianity is the unique revelation of God, that it's the truth. Pascal says something very interesting in Pensée 747. Let me read that to you real briefly. And again, enigmatic remarks when you first come across them, but on further reflection, you can get a lot of insight from some of Pascal's short, pithy sayings on this. On the fact that the Christian religion is not unique, far from being a reason for believing it not to be the true religion, it is, on the contrary, what proves it to be so. Pascal's always likes to try to turn the tables on his critic, on his objector. So the objector says, look, Christianity is not utterly unique. There are these themes of a dying and rising vegetation God, or there are themes characterizing the nature of God in other traditions. And Christianity is not unique, so it's not true. And he says, whoa, wait a minute. On the fact that the Christian religion is not unique, far from being a reason for believing it not to be the true religion, it is on the contrary what proves it to be so. Reminding me of a remark once made by C.S. Lewis, who said, if in order to be a Christian, I had to deny that there was any shred of truth in any other major world religion, I couldn't possibly be a Christian. Because that view of God and God's revelation in the world makes no sense to me. C.S. Lewis said, a much more sensible conception of God's revelation in the world is that God has never been without a witness. A biblical conception. And that in the various cultural traditions, some measure of divine truth has been grasped. In the Christian faith, we have the most complete and direct revelation of that truth, resonances of which and echoes of which are to be found in all sorts of places. That's a mark of its truth, that it's not totally disconnected from intimations of the divine elsewhere in human history. So a very line of reasoning that Pascal's critics thought to be a disconfirmation of Christian truth, Pascal turns the tables. Fascinating line of argument to consider in more detail. Fourthly, Pascal marshals many kinds of argument in favor of the deity of Jesus, the special status of Christ. Oh, there are just so many things he says about Jesus that the way Jesus' death was depicted in the New Testament, the way he spoke so simply, so clearly, and yet so profoundly, strand after strand of evidence concerning his extraordinary character and status and wisdom. Let me just give you an example of one of these lines of argument you find in the Pensées. And this will sound a little familiar to you because, again, there are echoes of this kind of argument in modern writers such as C.S. Lewis, whom I just mentioned. Pascal was a mathematician. In mathematics, a very common form of argument is called the reductio ad absurdum. You want to prove a certain thesis, you assume the negation or denial or contradictory of that thesis. You want to prove P, you assume not P, and then you show that it leads to an absurdity. Reductio ad absurdum, RAA proofs, mathematicians call them. Pascal does this as a mathematician, as a scientist, when he is thinking about religious belief. He says, suppose the apostolic witness to Christ were false. Suppose the things that the New Testament authors, suppose that the apostolic tradition and what it says about Jesus, about the resurrection, other things testifying to his unique status, suppose the apostolic witness is false. If it's false, then the following will hold. Either, one, the apostles were deceived, or two, the apostles were themselves deceivers. Now think about this. Pascal is saying, look, if the apostolic witness to Christ is false, then either they did not know it was false, in which case they were deceived, or they knew it was false what they were saying and nonetheless said it, in which case they were deceivers. Right? Those are the only two possibilities on the supposition that their witness to Christ is false. Now, Pascal says, consider this, has a couple of passages on this, 322, Pensées 322, he says, the apostles were either deceived or deceivers. Either supposition is difficult, for it is not possible, and now he's commenting on the first one, it is not possible to imagine that a man has risen from the dead. While Jesus was with them, he could sustain them, but afterwards, if he did not appear to them, who did make them act? Okay, so he's first confronting this possibility. The apostles were deceived. He says it's not possible to imagine that a man has risen from the dead. What is he talking about there? Why is he saying that? Very interesting. Early 20th century, mid-20th century philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein said that a mistake can only be so big. You ever walk down the street and you thought someone was coming that you knew? You thought it was someone you knew, and you got closer and you realized, no, it wasn't anyone that you knew. You had mistaken that person for an old friend. I could be standing here and mistakenly think that an old friend walked by the door outside. And that's a mistake that it's possible to make. But I couldn't mistakenly believe that 12 horses from Lexington were walking down the aisle. That's too big a mistake to make, right? At a certain point, the concept of a mistake breaks down, right? And it's an interesting thing about the concepts we have and the borders of those concepts. I recall when I was a little boy, about my son's age, 8 years old, my mother took me to the state fair in North Carolina, and they had these fellows who were shot out of cannons, you know, the Flying Zucchini Brothers or something. I can't remember what they were called, but I was just overwhelmed by this act. I mean, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world, to be shot out of a cannon. Could I get their autograph? And so my mother said, sure. I had bought a little plastic sword with a wide blade, and that was the only thing I had for them to write on. So they took a magic marker and wrote, you know, George Zucchini or whatever his name was on the blade of the sword. And I was so proud I got it home. And I decided, though, once I got home, I didn't like the autograph on the blade. I would rather have the autograph on the handle. So I erased the autograph and transferred it to the handle. Well, I went and got a magic marker and I wrote it back. And my mother explained to me I didn't understand the concept of an autograph. You know? The autograph ceased to exist. It didn't get transferred. Now see, all our concepts have borders. There are appropriate applications of a concept. Wittgenstein says a mistake can only be so big. You know, you can be mistaken about a variety of things. You can be mistaken about some pretty important things, but there are limits to the concept of a mistake. That's what Pascal was picking up on. A man cannot imagine that someone he knows very well has been raised from the dead. It's too big a mistake to make. When you think about the mindset, the philosophical views, the components of the worldview available to the apostles in their time, it was too big for a mistake. Very interesting. Well, suppose we consider the other possibility. The apostles, you know, they didn't make a mistake. Suppose they were wrong. What they were saying was false. Jesus was not raised from the dead. Supposing that, and they weren't deceived about it because they could go check and they would know, and it's not possible to make that big a mistake. So if they knew that what they were saying was false, then they were deceivers. All of them. Well, now what about that? Pascal says concerning that possibility, in Paul say 3:10, the hypothesis that the apostles were knaves, deceivers, is quite absurd. Follow it out to the end and imagine these 12 men meeting after Jesus' death and conspiring to say that he had risen from the dead. This means attacking all the powers that be. The human heart is singularly susceptible to fickleness, to change, to promises, to bribery. One of them had only to deny his story under these inducements, or still more because of possible imprisonment, tortures, and death, and they would all have been lost. And he says to himself, follow that out. The end of the note. Now that's very interesting. A conspiracy of deceit. Think about how tough it is to be a liar. Do you know anyone? Have you ever known anyone who was a habitual liar? I have. It's hard work to be a habitual liar. You have to have, first of all, an astonishing memory, because you never have reality to back you up, right? You're creating an alternative reality in your lies. You have to remember what you've said, because there are not going to be any objective traces of what you've got to remember what you've said. You've got to be extremely creative, extremely careful. It requires an awful lot of hard work. Now imagine a group of people, Pascal says, meeting together after Jesus' death, actually and agreeing to lie about something extremely important. An agreement among people to lie is a very strange sort of agreement when you think about it, right? A conspiracy of lies, because you're having to promise each other, okay, you know, I'm going to tell this lie, I'm going to sustain this lie, and I promise I won't let the truth be known. You're accepting the promises of liars, right? So, it's a very strange and unstable sort of agreement from the very start. Have you ever seen an episode of the TV comedy Cheers where Norm and Cliff are coming into the bar and they're seeing a John Wayne movie or something, and they're coming in saying, "Yeah, that was a time when a man could be a man. There's no longer in our culture, a man can't be a man anymore. And some guy sitting on the other side of the bar says, "Have you tried skydiving?" And they hear, and they ignore him, and they say, "Yep, no more opportunities to be a man, to look fear in the face." And then, "What about skydiving?" the guy says. And again, they try to ignore him, and pretty soon they can't ignore him. And so now it's put up or shut up. They've been saying they're no longer any big challenge, no longer any way to exercise manly courage. And here's this guy keeps saying skydiving. So anyway, they end up on a plane. And I think it's George and Cliff and the bartender from Woody from Indiana, you know. And so they get on the plane and they chicken out. They can't jump, but they can't face the humiliation of getting back to Cheers and having to admit that they couldn't jump out of the plane. So they said, look, we got to make up a story. So they're going to make up a lie to all tell, a conspiracy of lies here. But they realize that in the group of people there on the plane is Woody Boyd. He is from Indiana, and Indiana folks don't know how to lie. I mean, there's a kind of an urban sophistication that the Indiana folks lack, that are required for this kind of deceit. So they say, "Look, Woody's here, we're gonna make it simple. We jumped, we opened the chute, we landed." Okay, let's just all say that. That's our story. We jumped, we opened the chute, we landed. It's that simple, okay? And they get back to the bar, and within minutes, Woody falls apart and the truth comes out. He can't even sustain that, anything that simple. Now, Pascal is saying, imagine these people meeting after the death of Jesus and conspiring in a lie, and is it a lie that's as simple as, "We jumped, we opened the chute, we landed"? Absolutely not. It's an extraordinarily complex lie, if that's what it is, about death and resurrection and a new form of embodiment and a divine confirmation of a mission and a miraculous activity. And it's just an extremely complex... The human heart, Pascal says, is amazingly susceptible to fickleness, change, bribery, inducements, threats. A conspiracy of lies about something that important in such a hostile environment, Pascal thinks, would never have held up. You find in many parts of the Pensées that Pascal is a shrewd psychologist. He understands the human heart, human thoughts, human emotions, human weaknesses. If the apostolic witness to Christ is false, then either the apostles were deceived or the apostles were deceivers, Pascal says, but neither of these suppositions is in the least credible. Therefore, we should believe the apostolic witness to Christ is true. Reductio ad absurdum argument. You suppose the opposite of what you want to demonstrate. You show that that supposition leads to absurdities, in this case, psychological and conceptual absurdities. And you then draw the conclusion that supposition must be false. That is to say, the apostolic witness must be true. Now, there's a lot more to be said about this, but again, I just wanted to introduce you to some of these lines of thought to be found in Pascal to give you a sense of the richness of what the Pensées has to offer concerning evidential matters. Christian anthropology, a success argument, something about world religions, various lines of reasoning about Jesus. Pascal often has fascinating things to say about the Bible and its credibility as a document, actually recording veridically the experiences of God's people. Pascal has fascinating things to say about biblical prophecy, and some contemporary scholars think that Pascal's remarks about prophecy are dated. Well, they're just an attitude about prophecy indexed to the worldview and mindset of a former century. But when you read Pascal carefully on prophecy, you see that he has extraordinarily insightful things to say. Pascal thinks that biblical prophecy is also a mark of the truth of the Christian faith. Pascal has fascinating things to say about the Jews, their history and credibility as witnesses of the truth. And finally, Pascal has a good deal to say, in a very interesting vein, about the miraculous, about miracles. Pascal has a much better definition of the idea of a miracle than most philosophers who've ever thought about it. And he has an uncanny insightfulness about how miracles function in the confirmation of religious truth. I wish I had time to go on and on about the about Pascal's attitude toward miracles, but there are some other things I need to tell you about, because this is the best known argument that Pascal ever developed. And most people who don't know anything else about Pascal's religious thought, they've heard of this famous argument. Because Pascal thought the evidence, once you run through all these different categories, once you explore all the arguments available in each and every one of these categories, you find a tremendous body of evidence in favor of Christian truth. A tremendous body of evidence. And yet, Pascal realized that as soon as he developed a complex argument concerning any of these categories of evidence, as I was saying yesterday, any complex argument allows of doubt at some juncture in the argument. There'll always be some premise or some transition in the argument where a skeptic could say, well, I'm not sure about that. So what can we do? Many of Pascal's friends thought, okay, yeah, all right, there are lots of strands of fascinating reasoning and evidence in favor of Christian truth, right? But there's also evidence to the contrary, right? I mean, there's a problem of evil. If there's a good God, why would He allow all the suffering in the world? And there is this hiddenness problem, and there are contrary considerations that have to be taken account of. So some of Pascal's friends who were trying their best to be open-minded about it, they would say, okay, all right, there's a body of evidence for Christian truth, but there's also some evidence to the contrary. So we live in an ambiguous world. For some of Pascal's friends, he was able to get them from their atheism to at least agnosticism. To saying, well, okay, I'm not so sure anymore. And as a matter of fact, I had this experience recently at Notre Dame. I was teaching a course called Philosophical Reflection on Christian Belief to about 200 students. And had teaching assistants who led discussion groups on Friday. And one of the teaching assistants came to me the very last Friday of the semester after his sessions, and he said, Professor Morris, I want to tell you what one of the students said in class today. He said, this was a student who from the very beginning of the semester was a militant atheist, who was obnoxiously militant in his atheism. Every discussion group was dominated by this guy attacking everybody else. And as the semester went on, about a third of the way through the semester, he started saying fewer obnoxious things per discussion group. And then toward the end of the semester, he had gotten pretty quiet. And I just wanted to let you know, he came up to me today after discussion group and said, look, I just wanted you to know, you know, in case you were interested, I've started going to church again. And don't think I believe this stuff, okay? It's not like I've become a Christian or anything. But Professor Morris has made me see this semester that I don't know nearly as much as I thought I knew. And for the first time in my life, I could see that as tremendous progress in the life of a person. Socrates said that he had a form of wisdom which consisted just in realizing how much he didn't know. A lot of Pascal's friends thought they knew that there is no God. Pascal marshaled enough evidence so that many of those friends of his would be moved to realize how little of what they thought they knew about ultimate reality they really knew. And so some of these folks get into a kind of a more humble posture where they're saying, okay, I thought I knew atheism to be the truth. I thought I knew Christianity not to be the truth. And there's all this evidence here, but there is still some other consideration. And ambiguous. The world is ambiguous. I don't know the answers. I don't know what the ultimate truth is. Pascal thought that if he could get a person into at least that state of mind, he had another argument which could lead the person the rest of the way. Probably the most famous single argument for religious belief in the history of philosophy. Pascal's wager. Every other major philosophical argument for religious belief is an argument that we ought to believe because it's true. Is an argument for the truth of theism or the truth of Christianity. Every other argument is an argument either intended to demonstrate that there is a God or to raise the probability of the claim there is a God. Pascal's argument is completely different here. The wager argument has nothing to do with proving there's a God or giving us extra evidence to enhance the probability that there's a God. It's an argument that we ought to believe that doesn't give us any new evidence at all on the basis of our confusion rooted in the ambiguities that we might think face us is an argument that we need to take an extra step. Let me explain how this argument goes. Pascal's friends, I mentioned last time, he lived life in the fast lane in Paris. This was a time in human history where, tell you, I used to live in New Haven, Connecticut. In New York City, whenever any very wealthy person was having a party, they would try to make it a success. They would always try to include some TV people, some movie people, some faces that had been on the cover of Sports Illustrated. You know, this is how you have a lively party. Well, in Pascal's day, when you wanted a really lively party, you invited mathematicians and scientists. It was a very different historical period, right? So Pascal and the people he hung around with, it was life in the fast lane. It was the lifestyles of the rich and famous in Paris of the 17th century. The main occupation of his friends was gambling. Now, these are his religiously indifferent friends who don't care about religious belief at all or seem not to care. What do they occupy their time with? Well, parties and gambling. And Pascal, thinking about the fact that they gambled, it leads Pascal to realize all of life is risk, in a sense. We don't know that we can do something right now to secure our very continuation on this earth for the next 2 or 3 hours. Everything we do, we're making a calculated gamble. How should I spend my time this afternoon? Where should I go? What should I do? We're always making a bet that one activity is more valuable for us than another. There are not many certainties to be had in this life. And that's why we enjoy, Pascal thought, the sporting event or the gaming event, because things come out clearly there. We can see there's a clear, like in a football game, there's a winner and there's a loser. And so often in life we can't tell, are our gambles coming out right or are they not? Are we placing our bets in life in the right way or are we not? Sometimes it's a little ambiguous. Well, consider the way we place our bets. Pascal considered the way his friends placed their bets. Now, how does a rational gambler seeking to maximize his gains over the long run, how does he bet? Well, Pascal realized there are two goals you could have in gambling. One is to maximize your gains, and the other goal would be to minimize your losses. Well, if your goal is to minimize your losses, you know, stay home from the track. Don't bet at all. Then you won't have any losses. Well, his friends were going out and gambling every day. So he thought, well, evidently their strategy, and he looked at what their strategy was, and he found out that it was the strategy of maximizing gain over the long run. And so they had this ability, the good gamblers of Pascal's day, to make rational bets and to actually accumulate wealth over the long run. Pascal looked at how they did this. What's the mathematics of it? How does it work? He realized that in any betting situation, there are a number of factors. Let me give you an example of how these factors can interact. In very simple numbers here, just to make our point, just to illustrate the point. Suppose you have a horse race, horse A and horse B. You can either bet on horse A or you can bet on horse B. And suppose they've run against each other under similar conditions many times in the past. And half the times A has won and half the times B has won. So just based on the probability considerations, probability of one half and one half, like flipping a coin, you're not going to know whether to bet on A or whether to bet on B. The evidence is ambiguous. It's balanced between them. But suppose that payoff for horse A is $200. If you bet on A and win, you get $200. The payoff on horse B is $100. If you bet on B and win, you get $100. Now, you'd never come across a situation like this, right? But we're using these numbers to make an important point. Because in every gambling situation, there is a matter of probability, there's a question of payoff, there's a question of cost. What's it cost to make the bet? Suppose $10, you put down $10 and you can make your bet. You can choose your horse to bet on. Well, Pascal realized that his friends, who were rational gamblers, trying to maximize their gain over the long run, they bet in accordance with a formula. Probability times payoff, and subtract from that the cost, and that yields a mathematical quantity known as expectation, mathematical expectation. Now, expectation is an abstract quantity. It's not the amount of money you expect to get if you bet on the horse and win. The amount of money you expect to get is the payoff. But expectation is the abstract quantity you use in calculating which bet to make, which horse to bet on. You bet on the horse with the highest expectation. That is to say, when you place a bet, you don't just do it on the basis of probability. You have to consider also payoff and cost. Those three things all need to be considered, and the way in which they interact is captured by the expectation formula. Probability times payoff, subtracting cost, yields expectation. In this example, given the artificial figures we've plugged in, if you're a rational gambler wanting to maximize your gains over the long run, you bet on horse A. That's the rational bet to make. It's the horse with the higher expectation. Pascal saw that this is the way his friends placed their bets. Now, typically, expectation tracks along with probability. So, you know, at the track, the horse with the highest chance, the probability, would also carry the highest expectation. That's often the way it goes. But I give you the chart with these kinds of figures to show that even where there's a balance in probability, the expectation of one can be greater because of one or the other of the other two quantities. Okay? And even it's possible for the horse with the lower probability to end up with a higher expectation. Even though it's less likely that he win the race, if he does, you get so much more payoff, or it's cost you so much less to place the bet, that you're better off going with that horse, with that higher expectation, over the long run. Now, that's the formula Pascal discovered. And then he realized, wait a minute, with the matter of religious belief, everyone is making a wager. Every human being alive is either betting on God or betting against God. And there's no equivalent to staying home from the track. This is interesting. And he says, why? Because either you're living as if there is a God, you're seeking God's guidance in prayer, or you're not seeking God's guidance. You're living out of your own resources. You're living as if there is no God. So either you're living as if there is a God, or you're living as if there is no God. The agnostic who doesn't pray or try to living as if there's no God. There's no middle ground. You're making one wager or the other. Okay. There's this and there's that. Well, yeah, there are a lot of other religions, but Pascal believed that once you looked at all the evidence, you would see that basically this is what it comes down to. And we actually had a philosopher, very, very well-known philosopher, a few years ago. Atheist most of his career. And this philosopher said he had become a Christian. And one of the graduate students there at Notre Dame at the time asked him how this came about. And he said, well, I felt there was something in my life that was missing. And maybe one of the world religions had something to offer me. I was not feeling complete, fulfilled as a person. So he said, I started reading all of the world's great religious literature. The Koran, the Upanishads, Vedas, everything I could get my hands on. And after considering all of what these religious documents said, and after considering all the evidence available in favor of the truth of what they said, I decided that basically it came down to this. Either atheism is true, or some form of Judaism is true. Either original Judaism or Christian Judaism. If any religious belief is true, it's some version of Judaism. Old Testament Judaism or Christian Judaism. And then on further reading, I determined it's Christian Judaism. I'd never even heard anyone use the phrase Christian Judaism about Christianity like that. And here's a philosopher who did what Pascal believes that if any rational person were to do, it would come up with the same two alternatives to choose between. No God at all, or the Christian God, finally. Okay, suppose the world is ambiguous to a particular searcher who's looking into this, an inquirer, one of Pascal's friends, who's saying the evidence is ambiguous. Is there a God or not? I don't know, 50-50, 60-40, who can tell? The world is ambiguous. There's some signs of the existence of a God and the truth of Christianity, but there are other darknesses and mysteries, I just don't know what to say here. Well, Pascal thought that if on the basis of all those kinds of evidence we put up, if he could get a person at least to the point where he says, well, 50-50, I don't know, then Pascal would say, okay, now consider the other factors. What's the payoff if you bet on atheism and you're right? If you wager on atheism and atheism ends up being true, what's the payoff? What do you get? Well, a finite amount, some finite quantity of payoff. And what do we mean here? Well, if you're an atheist and you live as an atheist, you can live any way you want to, in a sense, right? I mean, you don't think that your worldview is such that in virtue of being an atheist, you won't have missed out on anything. I mean, if atheism is true, if that ends up winning the race, right? If atheism is true, then in virtue of having been an atheist, will you have had to block yourself off from any of the enjoyments of the world? You do whatever you want if you're an atheist. You live according to your own lights. You want to be a moral person, you can be a moral person. You don't feel like being a moral person? Well, there's no reason you would have to be. Live however you want. Enjoy yourself any way you please. Only for so long, though. There's only a finite number of years on this earth. Only a finite number of things you can indulge yourself in. So there's some finite payoff if you bet on atheism and it's right. You get a certain number of pleasures. And what's the cost of being an atheist? Well, small or none. Well, wait a minute. Wait a minute. Doesn't the atheist have to give up certain things? Well, see, you can't. Now, this is the interesting thing. You can't assign the cost based on what's actually the truth. You can't say, well, you know, the cost is losing eternal life, or maybe it's eternal suffering, or maybe eternal deprivation, or you can't, because what we're talking about is the cost up front, before the race has been won. Like the $10 that you put up at the horse race here. What's up front, the cost? Well, doesn't an atheist have to give up stuff to be an atheist? Doesn't an atheist have to give up the joys of religious community, for example? When I was at Yale, I knew some atheists who went to church regularly. And when they were asked why, they said, I enjoy it. Well, What do you mean you enjoy it? You don't believe in God and you go to church and you enjoy it? Yeah, the liturgy is nice and it's a pretty place and the people are all really nice. And so an atheist need not even give up the joys of religious community if they're shrewd enough in their atheism, right? I mean, they need not even incur the cost of any kind of persecution. You can be an atheist in secret. You don't have to let anybody know you're an atheist. So is there any kind of cost you incur? Well, some people say none at this point, but I say, you know, the atheist at least gives up a certain hope. Gives up a certain hope for everlasting fulfillment of a certain kind. And that's something to consider. But from the atheist's point of view, he's giving up something that he's not giving up anything that's there to be given up. And so it's hard to assign much of a cost. So, but what do you do here? Probability times payoff, subtract cost, the upfront cost. You get some kind of finite expectation. Okay. The Christian God, probability. Let's say something about the cost, finite cost. Of being a Christian, you can't do that in secret, right? You can't hide your light under a bushel. You have to be willing to take whatever persecution attaches itself in your social environment to being a Christian. You have to be prepared to do things that don't always feel like loving your neighbor as yourself, right? Your neighbor may be a jerk, you know, and so it's tough, you know, and you may not always feel like, you know, not forsaking the assembling of yourselves together. It might be tough to do. There are some costs associated with being a Christian, but a finite number of costs. And as a matter of fact, Pascal thinks that the fulfillment for a Christian in this life is such as to more than negate any of the costs that we incur in virtue of being Christians. So, but you know, what we're trying to do here is come up with something that'll be persuasive to the atheist or agnostic. So let's grant that there's some finite cost to being a Christian. But now we plug in this, what's the payoff? If you're a Christian, it's a sort of a crass term, right? But we have to live with it, with this kind of chart. If you're a Christian and you're right, you win the wager, what comes from having made that wager? Everlasting bliss. Everlasting bliss. Infinite, infinite payoff. When you're talking everlasting, you're talking about a quantitative infinite. And many folks have suggested that there's something like a qualitative infinite as well in store for the Christian. Well, anybody who knows anything about the mathematics of infinity, it doesn't take long to figure this one out. A non-zero probability, however small, multiplied by an infinite quantity subtracting any finite cost gives infinite expectation. You bet in accordance with a higher expectation, Pascal says, the only rational bet, the only rational wager, is to wager on the Christian God. Well, what is it to wager on the Christian God? I mean, what am I supposed to do? In the Pensée, Pascal has an unbeliever, a dialogue partner, an imaginary dialogue partner, say, okay, this is very interesting, but what am I supposed to do? How am I supposed to wager? I mean, if somebody said to you, I'll give you $10,000 right now if you believe instantly that you are sitting on top of a flagpole in Nome, Alaska with a tiny pig on your left hand. And $10,000 is a lot of money. And I would be very favorably disposed toward the proposition that I'm sitting on a flagpole in Nome, Alaska holding a small pig. I would try to imagine that scenario. I would have warm feelings about it. But belief is not under our voluntary control. I cannot just say, okay, I believe it. Well, I could say it to try to get the $10,000, but I can't make myself believe something just because of a reward that's offered or a payoff that's presented to me. Belief is not that. So Pascal's friend says, but I can't make myself believe. This is a great argument. I'd love to wager on the Christian God, but how do I do it? And Pascal doesn't think you can make yourself believe anything. You believe what seems to you to be true. That's a basic psychological fact. Pascal, wagering is actually seeking, expecting to find. Pascal says to his dialogue partner, and I paraphrase here, start doing religious things. Start hanging around with religious people. Start trying to pray. Start reading the Bible. And read it positively. And let your imagination get carried away with it. Dwell imaginatively on the claims of Christianity. Hang around the right sort of people. You become like the people you're around. Start living your life in a certain direction. And then you'll begin to see the truth that's out there to be seen. You're already wagering in one way or another. Has reason inclined you against the Christian wager? Pascal thinks it can't happen. It must be your desires, contrary desires, what Pascal calls concupiscence. Let me put something up real quick, but our time's about over, so I don't want to dwell on this too long, but I thought I should at least mention this. The two wagers have an interesting difference. The unbeliever wagering against God, if he's right, he can never have the satisfaction of finding out that he was right. And for an interesting reason, either if he's right and there's no God, then there's no life after death either, so he's not around to find out that he was right. Or if there is some kind of a naturalistic life after death, then presumably that world would be just as ambiguous as this world to him. So again, he couldn't say, aha, see, I told you I was right. If he's wrong, he will face the disappointment of learning he was wrong. Now the believer, if he's right, he will have the satisfaction of finding out that he was right. If he's wrong, he will never face the disappointment of learning he was wrong. If there's no God and no life after death and no way. So, unbelief carries with it a no satisfaction guarantee, and belief carries with it a no dissatisfaction guarantee. So Pascal says, get it in gear in the right direction. One more thing, the chain of experience. Pascal says, most of us think that this is the way experience works. There is this objective situation, the situation we're in right now. And that gives rise to our perceptions, what we see. We see the inside of this beautiful chapel and each other because we're here in the chapel with each other. And then our perceptions give rise to our emotions, what we feel. And our emotions give rise often to our behavior, what we do. Pascal thinks, and he's so shrewd in his psychology at this point, that you can reverse this chain as well. He wants the unbeliever to start acting in a new way. And Pascal realizes that acting in a new way will give the unbeliever new emotions and will give the unbeliever new perceptions and will actually change the objective situation he's in and put the unbeliever in a position to see the evidence that's been there all the time but that he's been blind to. When Pascal says, wager your life, he means to launch yourself wholly in a new direction. Wagering is a matter of the heart. What is the heart? The heart is the entirety of behavior, emotion, perception. The heart is the deepest seat of all our thoughts and feelings and attitudes. Pascal realizes that there are all kinds of beliefs you can have concerning religious matters, but there are also attitudes you may have and emotions. He wants to portray the Christian faith in the Pensée accurately, so that the unbeliever will actually find it attractive. Get the emotions in gear. He wants to portray the Christian faith in the Pensées in such a way that even the unbeliever will find it promising. Promises that are wonderful. The unbeliever will have a new attitude and hope that it's true. You will want it to be true. You'll feel attracted by it. You'll hope that it's true. You'll start launching your life in a certain direction. And after a certain amount of wagering, with true humility, seeking for the truth, Pascal believed that any sincere person would come to see the evidence and come to know God. The best definition of faith Pascal ever gave was this: faith is God perceived by the heart? And the heart is not, when we're doing that, when we're using the heart as a metaphor, we're not doing, you know, coronary metaphysics or thoracic epistemology. The heart is a metaphor for the entirety of your being. Emotions, attitude, reason, everything wrapped together. Faith is God perceived by the heart. Throw your life in a Godward direction, and God will be there to embrace you. The message Pascal gave to all his friends in the 17th century, the message he so powerfully handed down to us. Thank you for being with me these sessions.
Tom, about our appreciation for your lectures. I know some of you have to go to class right now. We'll give you a couple minutes for those of you who have to leave, and the rest of you can stay around, and we'll have a time for a talk-back session, and you can ask some questions, and I'm sure you'll have some, for Dr. Morris. I'll give you a couple minutes to leave.
I even had overheads I didn't get to. But, you know, I was going to do some stuff on faith and stuff, and so I just wrapped it in the end.
Hi, Bob Lyons, professor of New Testament. Let me see you.